Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Cholley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, which political ads work? There's a big study out of America trying to get to the bottom of, is it going negative? Is it being positive? Is it issues? Is it emotions? Really fascinating chat with a US professor, and Mark Lucas, British ad man, who's worked on countless campaigns, particularly for New Labour and Blair and Brown. But really interesting on what might we see coming down the track on our TV screens, on our social media feeds during the election campaign this year. Before that, the columnists India Knight and James Marriott on Theresa May being the latest Tory MP to announce she's quitting. And is James Marriott good at Mother's Day? We ask his mother. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. But first, as we always do on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learned that Virgin Radio's Chris Evans is listening to the show.
I heard Matt Chorley was banging on about you on Friday. Matt Chorley from Times Radio is losing 8R to the Chris Evans Brooks Show. Well, again.
Well, he's dead to us now. We learned that Jeremy Hunt is listening to Peter Mandelson on how to win an election.
Keir Starmer needs to shed a few pounds, and that would be an improvement.
I know he's been taking advice from Lord Mandelson, who yesterday rather uncharitably said he needed to shed a few pounds.
We learned that Treasury Minister Gareth Davies can't count on Sky News.
I think that makes it close to 60 Tory MPs. That's around a sixth of the party choosing to stand down at the next election.
I think there's nearly 50 Labour MPs as well, just to be completely balanced about this.
I'm being told that the number of Labour MPs who are standing down at the next election is more like 17 rather than close to 50.
We learned that while Rishi Sunak is busy running the country, he's actually thinking about his wife being untidy.
Sure, but you also just don't like making the bed. I mean, it bugs me, so I actually sometimes come up back into the flat from the office after we've all left to make the bed.
Yes.
I'll be irritated if it's not one of his special skills.
We learned that Keir Starmer's got a new big book of mixed metaphors.
As the captain of the Titanic might have said, iceberg, what iceberg? Yeah. Smiling as the ship goes down, the Chuckle Brothers of decline, dreaming of Santa Monica.
But the main thing we learned this week is that Andy Goldstein and Darren Bent on TalkSport really enjoyed my budget analysis.
So, you know, if politics was like that, he's a funny guy.
Yeah.
I quite enjoy that, but all the other...
Politics without the boring bits.
Yeah, I like...
That works.
Yeah.
Do your little football analogy, then you have our attention.
Yeah.
If you talk proper...
No.
If you talk proper, you won't get us.
I don't have a clue what...
All right?
Yeah.
No, nor me. But we've done it now.
Yeah.
And we've done it well.
And that is what we learned this week. Now it's time for these two.
The Columnists with Knight at the Marriott, India Knight and James Marriott.
I was hunched on my bedroom floor with my laptop frantically battering away at my column.
It never gets old. Very good to have you both here. Hello to you, India Knight.
Good morning.
And James Marriott's here. How are you, James?
I'm good.
Good morning.
I see you're all dressed in black, James. Is it because of the news about Theresa May?
Yeah, I'm in mourning. Very tragic. Very sad. What will Parliament be like without her?
It's very sad news. How are you coping, India?
I'm holding up. I'm holding up. It's tough, but, you know, we do our best.
Now, I don't want... I mean, first of all, she's not died. She's just announced she's standing down from the House of Commons so that she can make more money. I mean, continue her campaigning elsewhere. I mean, she's only now being hailed as an extraordinary public servant because of the absolute dog's dinners that followed, isn't she, India?
Yeah, she was... I mean, I think of her very much as the kind of last competent grown-up who had a broad idea of what people's concerns were. The three ones afterwards, not so much.
I'm going to disagree with you, India. I think she was rubbish.
She wasn't great, but in context, in the context of what came after, she was magnificent. I mean, she wasn't magnificent in the context of herself. She was just, everything became such an incredible shower after the end of her tenure that, you know, it reflects rather gloriously on her.
But she...
And she was a decent person, you know. She was recognisably a decent person doing her best. And I'm not sure
unless you were being targeted by a hostile environment or the, you know, the Windrush scandal, the go-home
ban. Of course, of course, of course.
The cuts to the police. Anyway, what do you think, James?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of... You're beginning to persuade me. I kind of started out thinking, you know, along India's lines, that she was at least the last person... who seemed to have, you know, kind of principles. And when you think about how Liz Truss has been spending her post-prime ministerial career, Theresa May looks pretty good. But then anyone looks pretty good. You know, Boris Johnson looks like a kind of shining beacon of, you know, morality and good sense compared to Liz Truss giving speeches to these kind of dodgy right-wing organisations in America. Yeah, I'm sort of finding it weirdly nostalgic. I'm suddenly at that whole world of, you know, indicative votes and backstops and, you know, which was the news.
Just it was forever and ever and ever and ever.
It was a complete mess. She was clearly... not competent to do that job.
She took on Brexit. She declared Brexit means Brexit, which what she actually meant was a hard Brexit. She told all of the Remainers to clear off she was going to pursue this hard Brexit. She spent 3 years trying to ram it through, and it didn't work. And it was a total waste of time. She achieved nothing in terms of domestic politics, and she didn't even get Brexit done. It was a total waste of time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of ever since that 2016 vote, politics in Britain's just become this bucking bronco. And, you know, it threw David Cameron off. Theresa May couldn't ride it. And, yeah, I think that's how we might remember her as the kind of, you know, one of the first victims of the... I know, one of the kind of first victims of this new, utterly volatile, unmanageable era of politics.
But she was in part responsible for that. She had Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill were their chief of staff, who basically installed her in Downing Street, despite having none of the... obvious skills required to lead a party and a country, particularly at a massive crisis. She pursued a hard Brexit. She ruled out the customs union. And then she just kept trying to ram it through with the evidence that it wasn't going to get through.
Yeah, it is true.
And then only on the steps of number 10 did she start talking about compromise, having refused to compromise for the previous 3 years.
It is true. There's a kind of series of prime ministers, starting with Theresa May, who basically seem to have lacked the fundamental attributes required of a prime minister. Boris Johnson, obviously, Liz Truss, obviously, Rishi Sunak now seems to look the same. You know, people who you can't even say, you know, it's difficult for them, but, you know, they had at least some of what it takes. These people who just seem to lack the fundamental competence to govern. And, I don't know, this kind of weird era of, like, four or five prime ministers in a row.
Yeah.
I think that's how she's going to be remembered, bundled up in that little moment of chaos.
I mean, I do think she's been phenomenally lucky that she has been followed by what she has, because she's now not regarded as... Because when she resigned, I looked this up because I'd sort of slightly forgotten, it was Andrea Leadsom who basically did her in, who ran against her for the leadership, then became an actually very, very loyal supporter of her. And she was trying to bring back another Brexit deal to the House of Commons. And Andrea Leadsom said, I'm just not doing this as Commons leader. And that's why she resigned. And in the end, she had to go. And... you know, she was declared the worst prime minister. You know, she'd somehow managed to overtake David Cameron, had the referendum. And it's
okay,
only
I've
because...
I've changed my mind. You're very persuasive.
I think it's also extraordinary how easily being an ex-prime minister gives you this automatic statesman-like gravitas. You know, I'm sure when John Major lost in 97, how many people would have thought he would be this kind of elder statesman, you know, wheeled out every other week to make a rare intervention on, you know, morality and politics. And... I mean, you don't have to do much. If you're just careful, stay in Parliament, do your PR right, don't go to America and make speeches to lunatics. That gravitas quite easily, you know, acquires to you. I mean, the same in America with presidents. You know, George W. Bush now seems like a kind of, you know,
to a lot of people who really hated him, he now seems like a kind of adult in the room. And I think it's probably worth remembering, just stick around in Parliament, you can actually look like a kind of pretty serious figure without much effort.
But even then, particularly during Boris Johnson's time, she was like constantly needling him, exactly the sort of thing that she complained about people doing to her, to the point that Nick Timothy, who used to be her chief of staff, told me on Times Radio that she was in danger of looking like Ted Heath in a dress.
extraordinary images.
Anyway, there is one good thing. There's one good thing that Tory MPs are clinging to, the sign of hope that Theresa May gives us. Earlier I spoke to Conservative MP Harriet Baldwin. She's not standing down, but she explained about the silver lining they can take from Theresa May's time. Let's take a listen.
That 2017 general election campaign, it ended up being one of those campaigns that just didn't work out. And, you know, you can say that each prime minister we've had has had strengths and weaknesses. And I think, you know, clearly that 2017 campaign didn't go as well as it should. But I think it's something also that I look at now with great hope, actually, because you can go into an election campaign 20 points ahead and still end up not winning. So I'm hoping that things will turn around for my party and that we will do really well in 2024.
There we are. There's hope yet, India.
Yeah, right.
Right. Although somebody has just messaged in. Who was it? John Michael says, there is perhaps no more damning statement about any political figure in British history than she couldn't even thrash Corbyn. But she called a general election she didn't need to call with a 20-point lead and ended up losing her majority.
Yeah, not a brilliant moment of political strategy, is it?
No. But anyway, lots of you are getting in touch. Let us know what you think about Theresa May. 0333 003 2353. Because I just think it's one of those things that just by hanging about in the Commons for the last few years and now standing down, everyone's always marvelled, isn't it? Public service is what we want. Just rubbish. Anyway, let's move on. J.K. Rowling. Let's talk about her, India. She's been reported to the police by the broadcaster India Willoughby over claims of transphobia. It's because J.K. Rowling called India Willoughby a man in a post on Twitter and is now being reported to Northumbria Police. What do you make of this, India?
I'm only very dimly aware of who India Willoughby is. I gather she's one of the presenters on Loose Women. And I also know that there is kind of long-standing beef between India Willoughby and J.K. Rowling. But in this particular instance, I don't think I've ever particularly enjoyed any opinion that India Willoughby has come out with. I've heard her on the radio a couple of times. However, in this instance, India Willoughby is legally a woman. And I think I agree with some of what J.K. Rowling has said in the past on this issue, by no means all of it. But I think there's an enormous difference between a grotesque rapist presenting himself at court in a blonde wig and saying, I'm now a woman, put me in a woman's jail, and people who have struggled and had difficulties and who are legally women. So I think deliberately misgendering somebody in this way is, apart from anything else, just really rude and also mean. And I'm a bit disappointed that J.K. Rowling has done it.
And because, I mean, this whole area is so fraught with people on both sides saying, you know, bad faith, ill will, you know, be over the top. So, yes, so J.K. Rowling wrote on Twitter, India didn't become a woman. India was cosplaying a misogynistic male fantasy of what a woman is. Okay, politeness will get you quite a long way in this debate, James.
Yeah, I think so. There was a really good column by Janice Turner in The Times a couple of weekends ago, obviously famous for her gender-critical views, where she was saying, you know, the legal battle is one thing and it's important, but also you can extend courtesy to people and, you know, using whatever pronouns people want, that can just be a simple form of politeness. There's an interesting split in the gender critical movement going on at the moment, where I think a lot of people like, you know, Janice, who were there from the very beginning, are now saying, okay, you know, I've actually won a couple of, you know, really important battles and we don't have to, you know, let's not go too far, let's stay polite, let's stay reasonable. And I think there were some other people who I think, you know, maybe have, obviously, this is not J.K. Rowling, who kind of, you know, got into this a bit later, are, you know, full steam ahead, let's be kind of rude and antagonistic in a way that I don't think is helpful. And I think, you know, Janice is actually a really sensible voice and represents, I think, probably the majority of sensible people who say, yes, there are problems to discuss here. You know, the stuff about prisons, you know, we think is really useful. The stuff about sport, we think is really important. But politeness is also important. And I think you know, all movements, you know, that are kind of carried along by this original momentum, you know, will split. And that split is happening now. And I do agree with India that I think J.K. Rowling kind of, you know, obviously she's been right about a lot, but you shouldn't just be rude, and that she's ending up on the wrong side of that split, I think, between the kind of polite people and the slightly ruder people.
There's also part of me who just thought, what is J.K. Rowling doing? Can't she write a book? Why is she?
And also, yeah,
because this is in the bottom of such like an enormous thread of people shouting awfulness at each other.
Well, I think when you're lionized, arguably a little bit rightly, for sticking your head above the parapet and saying things that lots of people think but are frightened to say, then, you know, that's probably quite addicting, and it's probably, you know, it probably makes you feel quite heroic to go on. And I think she has been in the past on occasion heroic, J.K. Rowling. And but also, can I just say this thing about performing femininity? I completely understand what she's saying, but I would add that natal women perform femininity all the time. I perform femininity every time I put some lipstick on. Mm. I perform femininity when I put on an apron and make dinner. I perform femininity if I put on high heels, which in fact I don't, but if I did, you know. So I don't know. It just seems mean. I don't want J.K. Rowling to be mean.
And it doesn't, I suppose the point James is making is it doesn't help the cause. It
doesn't advance the debate at all, no.
Yeah, and actually makes it less likely that more sensible, measured, nuanced, uncertain people even get involved in the discussion, because you just get this...
Yeah, well, it makes that cause, which has some very justifiable points, seem tawdry and petty and almost as bad as, you know, the other people who are just flinging around abuse on Twitter. It's why no one should ever go on Twitter.
which we shall come to now, James, because you now can't go on Twitter.
What a segue. Well, yeah, I actually can't. I can't do anything.
So get it out, as they say. Let's have a look.
This is my new phone from the 1990s. It's a Nokia 105.
Let me see.
It does nothing.
Look.
Yeah,
look.
I mean, you won't be able to do anything with it.
So
can you text on it?
You can text, you can take calls,
and
you can play Snake.
Each letter.
So unlock. How do I get into it? Unlock.
Middle button, then press. I think it's the right button to press the unlock thing.
Oh, you know, I'm in.
Do you want to go on Snake?
Hang on, you've got Facebook on here.
Do I?
Yeah.
That's cheating.
Well, I didn't realise that.
This isn't...
I think it's actually impossible to get a phone without Facebook.
You've got Friends Reunited on here.
I've got Friends Reunited.
You've got MySpace. You've got Napster.
The full 90s package.
So tell me why. So I'll be honest, it's very small.
Yeah.
It's like a small TV remote.
Yeah.
What is it? A Nokia what?
Nokia 105.
Nokia 105.
It's about as basic as you can get in the 21st
century. So it's a new
century.
Phone that you've bought.
Yes.
It's like a drug dealer's phone, right?
It doesn't look like a drug dealer. Yeah, I've been accused of being a drug dealer more in the last few days than
I couldn't think of anyone less likely, to be honest.
Well, that's my cunning plan.
I can see you maybe, you know, caught up in county lines, maybe.
Yes, well, all Times Radio listeners who want drugs, text me now.
Why, James? Why have you gone for a basic phone?
Well, I was... I think very addicted to my phone in a way that was making me a bit depressed. And I just sort of felt like I was finding it hard to read. I was finding it hard to concentrate. And I was just like, why do I have a smartphone? I don't really need it. So I got a phone that was a little less basic than this, which had WhatsApp, Google Maps, and the potential to do your email, and absolutely nothing else. And I was like, this will slightly protect me from the modern world. I'll read more, I'll think better, but it won't ultimately impact my life. Then I went to the Times Magazine and said, you know, there might this be interesting to write about. And they said, yes, but you have to at least try living with a completely, completely stupid phone that I'm actually really enjoying. This is blissful. Like, nobody has contacted me for like 2 days. I'm just dead to the world.
How long has it been?
So I had my old, the slightly stupid phone for 2 or 3 weeks now. This completely dumb phone I've only had for a couple of days. And this has been I really feel like I've exited the modern world. Like, it's eerie. Nobody texts, nobody WhatsApp, nobody can WhatsApp you. You can't check Twitter. I do feel like I've gone back in time in a slightly quite enjoyable way, actually.
Would you be tempted to do this, India?
Well, I have done it. I mean, I grew up without.
Well,
without
no, I mean,
it,
in the modern. Without, I mean, in the modern, we all did, but in the modern.
I don't look at it that often. I think because I'm old enough to remember not having it, and I think because I've had it for long enough that I've done all the fun stuff obsessively all day long. I think because I have a memory of life without smartphones, I don't find it that hard to like leave it on the kitchen table and go out for the day.
I think it's a real personality thing. I was talking to my girlfriend about this, and she was looking at her screen time on her iPhone. She spends like an hour a day on her phone. easily 4 hours a day.
Oh yeah, 5 or 6 on mine.
And she's not even trying to not look at it. She just isn't addicted to it. Whereas I was just like, I was the person who's just filling my WhatsApp group chats with links to funny videos. And I was really very, very addicted.
But presumably...
When you use it heavily, do you not feel... Because I remember when they came in, I remember being appalled by the idea that I'd be permanently available to anybody who wanted to contact me. And I thought that was really, really, that was kind of grossly intrusive. And I still think that a little bit. So if you spend 4 or 5 hours a day on yours, do you not think, well, when can I have like private time without being reachable?
Yeah, completely.
The part of the problem for me is that I sort of convince myself it's all productive work.
Yeah.
On the training, I'm sort of reading the papers or I'm writing emails or scripts or, you know. But actually what I'm probably doing is scrolling through Twitter and looking at Instagram.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty for us is it kind of is productive work because, like, you know, you see something on Twitter and that's a column or that's something we talk about here. That's the thing that has slightly unnerved me is, am I going to lose touch with the modern world and I'm going to be trying to tell you about stuff that happened 2 months ago?
I don't know how to break it to you, James, but you weren't really that in touch with the modern world.
Yeah, that is actually. Yeah, that's reassuring. Wait, just watch me now. Watch me now.
See how far you can disappear for the modern world. But are you going online? Can you check your WhatsApps and things on a laptop?
So I thought you could, but you actually can't. When you want WhatsApp on your laptop, it has to go through your smartphone and you can't. It kills it on the laptop with this thing.
So you can't be WhatsApped at all?
No, you can only text me. To buy drugs.
Heaven.
There we are. Well, let's find... So this is inevitably, because everything becomes content, that you will have to write on
a laptop. I'm doing a magazine feature, and I've been told I'm going to be holding an enormous kind of inflatable 90s phone.
Like Dom Jolly.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Dom Jolly, yeah.
So very that's good. Going to be very serious.
Well, let us know if you've managed to get up your phone. I don't know how you do that. Can you fax... You can fax us or you can email Matt at times.radio. Lovely stuff. Now, it's Mother's Day this weekend on Sunday, so get ready. India, you've written on your Substack about wanting to salute mothers of teenagers. Why?
Yeah, I think Mother's Day is broadly... Well, there are two Mother's Days, aren't there? There's the Mother's Day that involves adorable small children, and then there's the kind of much later Mother's Day, which is when your own mother is elderly and you celebrate that and you appreciate, because you're older, all of the stuff that she went through that you didn't necessarily appreciate when you were younger. But I think the bit that really needs celebrating and the bit is the kind of really unphotogenic bit. I think the bit when your children are kind of a nightmare and they're boiling with hormones and they've got acne and they slam doors and they shout and they're hostile and they want to do stuff that you don't want them to do. That's the really, really hard bit, I think, of parenting. And I think... the mothers of teenagers, you know, need a standing ovation and a pat on the back, which they probably realistically won't get on Sunday from their grumpy teenage kids.
They'll be making their own breakfast in bed.
They'll be making their own breakfast and buying their own daffs. But, you know, yeah, maybe the partners of those women could arrange for something nice to happen.
James, are you good on Mother's Day?
Yeah, I am pretty good. The flowers are in the post, not to spoil the surprise for my mum.
Well,
are you good?
Well, James... you have already spoiled the surprise, because I think joining us on the line is James's mum, Helen. Good morning, Helen.
Hello. Hi.
Now, James says he's very good on Mother's Day. Is that right?
Well, boringly, he is.
No! Oh, see, my mum would never be mean about me on the radio.
No, that's no help at all, Helen.
I'm hoping that... I'm glad to hear that the flowers are in the post, given that I can no longer contact him.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been WhatsApping him and wondering if he's alive?
Yeah. Well, his sister and I were talking about this yesterday. It's a real pain in the neck. We can't get hold of him.
James, what have you done? You've cut yourself off from your
own
mother.
Well, basically, flowers are the only way I can communicate now. If you ask me if I'm going to come on time to send you a single rose in the post, then you'll know that I'm coming or something like that. I don't know.
are you going to take up more letter writing?
Yeah, maybe I will. I mean, it's a bit bad for my slightly old-fashioned image, but maybe I'm too far gone already.
I think that's probably too far. Yeah. Helen, what was James like as a child? Was he a good boy?
He was, actually. All I'm going to say is quite boring. He was very good. He was very easy to bring up, but he's always had an old head on his shoulders. He was born at age 40, really.
Was he basically a young fogey? No.
Yeah.
So you're not going to see him at the weekend. You're not going up, James?
No, my mum is coming to visit in a couple of weeks, though, so I'll see her then. So she puts in the effort that way.
Well, that's very good. But at least that's important. Do you listen to him on the radio normally, Helen?
I have to confess, no, because I used to work on a Friday. It's a habit I need to re-establish.
Yeah, very
but you could listen back to it on the Times Radio app.
Yes, or on Politics Out the Boring Bits podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
terrible, terrible behaviour.
Oh, you read his columns. That's good. Well, he's only got three. He just repeats them. India, do you know what you've got coming for Mother's Day on Sunday?
I do not. I do not know. It's always sort of slightly random. The older they get, my children, the better they are. but there were certainly, you know, when they were sort of peak teenage, that, you know, I'd get a text at like, well, somebody would turn up with like an egg at 4 in the afternoon, or maybe breakfast, or I'd get a text that sort of 10 o'clock at night. So they're much better now, but no, I don't know. And my flowers and my mum are also on the way.
Helen, what was the worst thing that James did as a teenager?
Oh. It's a bit like Theresa May, isn't it?
ran through a field of wheat.
ran through a library.
I would never run in a library.
Oh, well, Helen, have a lovely day. Happy Mother's Day to Helen.
Dish any dirt.
No, well, you know, it's all very on brand. Helen, lovely to speak to you. Thank you for coming on. Yes. Happy Mother's Day to Helen. Happy Mother's Day to India. I assume, James, you've put some flowers at the post to India as well.
Yeah, my radio mother.
India Knight and James Marin. Of course, you can read them both in The Times and The Sunday Times. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk. And with your subscription, you'll of course be able to get your bonus episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits released every weekend if you are an Apple listener. Up next, we take a look at which political adverts work and which really don't.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Big Thing.
Advertising. Don Draper told his clients in the iconic series Mad Men is based on one thing: happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing is okay. You are okay. Well, in the coming months, you are going to see a lot of ads, but selling not the smell of a new car, but perhaps the smell of a new government. Party political broadcasts across TV and radio, videos, graphics and memes looping on social media. And yes, even the old billboard on the side of the road screaming with reassurance that whatever this party or that party is doing is okay. But do we really know what works? Which ads strike a chord and move the dial, pull on the heartstrings or strike fear into the heart of the nation? And which ones do we just drive by? Today, we examine the political ad, an inexact science or the art of the possible. A pioneering ad in the US used by Lyndon Johnson in the 1964 presidential election was strikingly simple, showing a little girl plucking petals from a flower before a nuclear blast fills the screen.
Six, eight, nine.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live.
Ad men Saatchi & Saatchi are credited with bringing American-style campaign ads to the UK with a 1979 Labour Isn't Working poster showing a picture of a snaking dole queue outside an unemployment office.
It's not that they don't care about the unemployed. They do. But it's no good having good intentions if you can't afford to carry them out.
Labour's Dennis Healey complained the Conservatives were selling politics like soap powder. But then people do buy a lot of soap powder. The Saatchis were behind another campaign that gave Labour strategists sleepless nights in 1992 with Labour's tax bombshell.
To pay for Labour's promises, the average taxpayer would end up being hit by an extra £1,000 tax bill.
It was credited with keeping John Major in office. By 1997, it was New Labour who'd harnessed the power of Adland, with campaigns including Pete Postlethwaite playing a cab driver. Or was he an angel?
Did you vote then, Tom?
How does he know your name?
I meant to, but we've been in casualty all evening.
Oh, of course you have. You hurt your arm, didn't you, Becky? Hairline fracture. Must hurt, though. Still,
he'll get better. Shame the health service won't.
But most of them just featured Tony Blair.
In 3 short years, his energy and leadership have transformed his party. What can he do for Britain?
Look, the Tories didn't get everything wrong in the 80s. I mean, let's just be honest about that, admit it. But Britain can be better.
More recently, the Conservatives have been putting Rishi Sunak front and centre.
I wanted to take you back to the context that we found ourselves in.
While Labour focused on the message that Keir Starmer isn't Jeremy Corbyn.
Working people up and down the country looked at my party, looked at how we'd lost our way, and they said no.
But what works? Mark Lucas is a British ad man who over 30 years has made films in 80 countries, most notably for New Labour in the 90s and noughties. And David Bookman is a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, who's been working on political persuasion for a decade. He's just worked on a study which analysed more than 600 US political ads across the 2018 and 2020 election cycles, trying to find out what works best. Is it talking about issues or appealing to emotions, being positive or going negative?
That question seems to actually not have an answer. That we tested almost 36 different hypotheses from practitioners that, you know, academics have debated. And the interesting pattern is we have this data from a bunch of different elections. So 2018, when we had our elections for Congress, 2020, we had another elections for Congress, as well as the presidential elections. And if you look in one particular election, you can see that, okay, ads that take a certain approach or a certain message work better. But then if you go to the next election, what works totally changes. So it doesn't seem like there's such a thing as the kinds of things that always make an ad better. What makes an ad better is just changing all the time.
Are we talking about topics? Are we talking about fonts? Are we talking about images? Should it have the candidate on it? Should it not have the candidate on it? Should it be positive? Should it be negative? Or all those things changing in terms of in one round of elections, a massive photo of the candidate with a really negative message will work, and then in the next one, you want the exact opposite. Is that what you mean by it's changing?
Yeah, so great question. So we're looking at sort of all of the above. So for example, is it positive or negative? We're looking at the use of certain persuasive techniques like testimonials. We're looking at whether the politician is, you know, making their case versus somebody else, things like that. And so I'll just give you one example. And, you know, these, it's always easy after the fact to tell a story about like, oh, why this makes sense. So you know, we don't know, you know, the following thing I'm going to say is about, you know, a little bit of speculation, but I'll give you an example of a pattern we see and what could be going on. So in 2018, we had our congressional elections here, and that was after the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. And Trump and his party in Congress had passed a lot of legislation that was actually quite unpopular. There was a bill to repeal parts of Obamacare that was very unpopular. There was a bill to lower taxes on corporations that was very unpopular. And so that year, we find that these Democratic ads that talk about issues are way more effective. And so if you just compare the ads that talk about issues and the ads that don't talk about issues, that year, the ads that talk about issues are, you know, way better than the ads that don't. Then you go to the exact same kinds of candidates running for Congress just 2 years later, and all of a sudden, the ads that talk about issues are, if anything, a little bit worse. And it's better to not talk about issues. And it might be, again, speculation, it could be because 2018 was a uniquely good year to talk about issues because the Republicans had kind of, you know, walked off a cliff in terms of voting for a bunch of things that were unpopular and they had a vulnerability, but that wasn't as much of a vulnerability in 2020, and that, you know, voters kind of already knew all that stuff.
It's so fascinating. Now, let's bring in Mark. Now, Mark Lucas, you worked for New Labour for a long time. You then worked on Brexit campaigns as well. And everything from sort of dramatic, almost cinematic, sort of profile-y, personality-led things to quite straightforward retail offers to negative campaigns. So in your gut, away from David's excellent research, do you think you know what makes a great political ad?
Yeah, definitely. Although, David, I'm a great admirer of yours and your work on polarisation and also your thing about storytelling on the doorstep, which I think is very, very powerful. But I think if I understand your conclusion, it's that you basically don't know. I reckon I know.
David's nodding. David is nodding. Yeah.
I could have saved you some time, David. look, these ads work when art, culture, politics and characters come together. And they exist in the mind of the public, not as political ads. And I actually think they shouldn't be called political ads or political advertising. I think what we're looking for is political storytelling and ideas. And I think we shouldn't be looking to the thing that's going to swing everything around. We should be looking for a storyline and a narrative that can unfold and develop, told by people who know what they're doing, not by politicians, with an understanding of what the emotional pulse of the country is, you know? On the day that Tony Blair is elected, some people say that all the people in Downing Street were handed Union Jacks and told to sing It's Coming Home, It's Coming Home. They certainly did sing that. And that was a football song from a previous 2 years football competition that was about pride in the country and refinding that pride. And I think what you need in a campaign is people who are from outside the campaign who can help articulate that feeling about the country and where it needs to go in a way that's a storytelling, not a advertising mindset. So in 97, we had Stephen Frears, who hated Tony Blair, but did some stuff. You know, we had Anthony Minghella, we had, you know, Danny Boyle. And some of these guys hated what the Labour Party was doing at the time, but we used them, you know, and we used them because we understood they could find a storytelling connection, a narrative connection with the public that politicians just can't. You know, and I've been on campaigns where we found that heartbeat is quite rare. And I've been on campaigns, you know, Ed Miliband's, where we looked for a pulse for a few weeks and there was just nothing, you know, and I had to walk away. There was nothing to even resuscitate. So it's not always present, but when it is present, that's what you're looking for. You know, Heraclitus, you can't step into the same river twice. You know, what's the point in figuring this all out after it's all happened? You've got to feel the pulse and try and figure out where it's heading. And I reckon one of the most powerful people, because I work with Stan Greenberg and with Bob Schramm and with Tad Devine, a lot of the American guys. But actually, Philip Gould was like a, you know, he was like a kind of magician in a way. He was using focus groups, but feeling them, not analyzing them, and feeding back that feeling. And he was a master at grasping not where people were, but where they, what they were feeling at that moment. And I think, you know, I mean, I love your work, David. I admire it hugely. My God, you're a master, and I'm a novice in some ways. But I have made a couple of thousand ads, and I've made loads of stinkers. Yeah. And the good ones are the ones that connect emotionally to the heartbeat of the country at that moment, and that's what you want.
Yeah.
What was so interesting, David, looking at your research, is that having data is obviously brilliant because, you know, if you go back to the 90s, putting up billboards and trying to sort of gauge what impact they were having, or TV ads, whatever. Well, the great thing about digital advertising now, like digital news, that, you know, and I've worked for The Times a long time. I was at Mail Online before, and you can see all the data all the time. That story's doing well. And then there's a temptation every time we write about this thing, people love this. We should do more of this. We should do more of this. And then suddenly they stop it. And you think, well, you wanted this yesterday. Why do you not want this anymore? And it's about, you know, the editor's role is to think, well, what's the country feeling right now? We've had enough of that now. We want a bit of this. These people don't know they want to know about this yet. You know, otherwise you might as well just run a porn site because you'll always have people who want to go there. And I suppose it made me think of that, not reading your research made me think of a porn website, but it made me realize that actually the point is it's about telling people sometimes something that they didn't know they thought rather than just repeating something that they keep telling you. David.
Yeah, I mean, I think great comments from both of you. And I think the distinction I would draw is what we're increasingly good at in social science is measuring kind of like the stages set of the campaign. And we want to kind of optimize on the margin of like, okay, do you want to run ad A, B, or C? You know, it's these very like on the margin type decisions. And there, like what we find in the research is that when you look across all this data, our best guess is that, you know, given kind of the table is set for a campaign, if you take two ads out of a hat, your best guess should be one is going to be like 50% better than the other. So that makes doing this experimentation really valuable because sometimes you make an ad that you think is going to be really good and it's not, you know, just like, you know, you write a story you think is going to be popular and it's not, or it surprises you. So that data, like, you know, there's kind of limits to how good we are at predicting things and can really surprise us, but there really are big differences in terms of how much better ads can be than each other. I think what Mark's getting at, though, is kind of a bigger picture question that I really basically agree with everything Mark said, that there's a bigger picture question of like, what is a campaign like about? What is the message of the campaign, right? So, you know, and I'd almost think about that as on some level, like, what do you think it means to vote for a candidate? What is it you're voting for, right? You know, in Obama in 2008, you know, the slogan was change, you know, and that wasn't about just, you know, okay, well, we want to run one ad that says change. That kind of reflected itself in everything the campaign did, and that reflected the mood of the country at the time. So I think there's those bigger, what should the message of the campaign be? Like, what do people think they're voting for stuff that I do think is beyond the reach of what we're looking at here and is really, really challenging to study, right? For I think the exact reason that you've identified, Matt, which is that until people see a campaign with that message, they might not realize that's what they want and that's what resonates with them. So, you know, I think that kind of question, I think currently remains a lot more challenging for us to study. There is some research actually consistent with this. My colleague down at the University of California at Los Angeles, Lynn Vavrick, has some great work looking at American presidents and how they kind of run on or don't run on the economy and kind of the message of the campaign that way. And fittingly, the title of her book is The Message Matters. And I very much agree with that. And I see what we're doing here is to say, okay, you've got your message set. And now how do you want to deliver it? And it turns out there's still a lot of room there to kind of optimize, basically. But I agree that's kind of like a next level down.
But I suppose in a way, it's almost reassuring that you haven't found the perfect recipe for an ad. Because that's all we'd see now. If it had to be, you know, 200-point Times New Roman in blue, and it like it always worked, that's all we'd be stuck with. Whereas, Mark, it turns out, because we're trying to sell a thing to human beings, it is art more than it is science.
Just briefly on that, I was going to say, I mean, I think that actually, what you just said, is my guess of part of what generates our findings, is that these campaigns are competitive. And so, and they also, you know, happen in the context of everything that's happened before. So for example, like that finding I told you about issues, that in 2018, that was a great year for Democrats to talk about issues. The reason that it's no longer a great thing for Democrats to talk about issues in 2020 might just be because people have at that point heard it before.
Yeah.
And so it's not that they stopped caring that, you know, the Republicans passed or, you know, this really unpopular bill in 2017, 2018. It's just that all the people that did care about it have changed their votes by this point. And so now it's time to talk about something else. And so I think there's that process of like, when you pick the low hanging fruit, you don't keep trying to, you know, pick the fruit. It's kind of gone. And now you got to move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I'm glad you haven't found the solution, David, because I'll be out of a job. I'll be ringing you up for work. Yeah, I mean, look, there is another aspect to this, which is the advertising, which I wouldn't call it that, but the storytelling has to be in tune with the candidates and with the feel of the campaign. And the candidate has to own those ideas and embody them, because if he doesn't or she doesn't, you're automatically onto a loser. And just to give you a small example of this, which I guess in a way comes down to leadership. You may know this or not, David, but wherever I've gone in the world to work, people always ask me, have you got that video clip of John Prescott punching a guy in the street?
As he walked through them, a local man chucked an egg at him almost at point-blank range. John Prescott immediately swung round and landed a punch straight on his jaw.
There was
He threw an egg at the Deputy Prime Minister and quite instinctively, he turned round and walloped him.
So I'm in the room, David and Matt, and this has happened and it's come on the telly and we've got senior lawyers and government ministers and indeed eventually a prime minister in the room. And everyone was like, oh God, we've got to sack him. What are we going to do? You know, God, how will we know what the right decision is? We could have focus grouped it if we'd had, 20 minutes and I'm sure got an answer. But Tony just said, hang on a minute. You know, John is John. He is who he is. And I'll deal with this. And that was, he came out the next morning, everyone was expecting a big announcement, you know, the campaign's lost its, you know, momentum, craziness. He just said, John is John, and he's the best deputy I've ever had, and that's that. And it just shut down the whole argument. And I think all advertising or all campaigns are like that. If the candidate owns the message, owns the story, it feels coherent to the public and authentic to the public. And if they half disown it, you know, which I've seen Labour politicians do, something's wrong, something's amiss, and the public feel it. And therefore, even if it's a great ad or a great idea, it will fall on stony ground. So look at the Edstone.
Now, our six pledges form the basis of our plan for working people. These six pledges are now carved in stone. They're carved in stone because they won't be abandoned after the general election.
Ed Miliband, you know, God knows who came up with that idea, but a humiliating, desperate act in a campaign that was probably a good idea on paper, I imagine, although what bit of paper, I don't know. But he never really owned it. It never felt like him, and it was an embarrassment and a humiliation.
And it feels like, on either side of the Atlantic, you need something to, you need to be saying something. So, you know, if you're selling washing powder, you're selling washing powder. You're not, you know, just saying go to a website and there may or may not be washing powder on it. You're, you know, and if you're a politician, you need to start with either a policy or what do you stand for, what are your values, and then find the best way to communicate them authentically. You can't start with, we need an ad, and then sort of, and look at all people across about this thing, and we'll sort of work backwards from that to suggest we're a bit concerned about that as well. Is that basically, do you think the case, David, in America as well?
You know, it's a good question. To be honest, I would say it's beyond what I think is like in like careful social science, like we've looked at carefully. I would say one thing that speaks to this a little bit in the experiment we did do is we have a few hypotheses we looked at about kind of how pushy the ads are, how kind of explicit they are that, okay, you know, vote for so-and-so, that speaks to this a little bit. And I would say again on that, it interestingly, you know, it really depends year by year. So it seems like the kind of thing that, you know, kind of as Mark was saying, seems it has to be something about kind of matching the mood. And I think sometimes yes, and maybe sometimes no. If I have one bone to pick with what I see is, at least on this side of the Atlantic, the kind of conventional wisdom of the political practitioners, it's the idea that you have to stay on message. And what they mean by that is basically just keep repeating the same thing over and over to make sure it reaches everybody. And I get the wisdom to that of like, make a campaign feel coherent. But I also think there can be a danger to it, which is that I think a lot of persuasion is driven by letting people know things that they didn't know before. And if the most compelling thing about your candidate is something everybody already knows, maybe you want to make sure that's a little top of mind for them, but you could also move to the second most compelling thing or the, like the worst thing about the opposition or whatever else. And so I think that's another theme that you could, that could be driving some of these results as well, is that, you know, back to that low hanging fruit conversation, once people already know something, you know, continuing to beat them over the head with it might not be the best thing to do.
I thought I'd end up agreeing with you, David. And so it turns out, I knew this would happen. Advertising works on repetition, right? Storytelling works on unfolding a story with twists and turns and surprises that leave you feeling satisfied at the end of that journey. And that is where we want to get to. And this idea that sort of spotty press officer Herberts are being clever by just repeating a message over and over again to journalists, it's insulting to everybody involved in that and frankly, also counterproductive. every ad I've ever tested that's done well, and we did test them and we do test them, has been against the wishes of the majority of the people involved in the decision-making process. I can guarantee you that's the one constant. And that's because they don't want to be surprised. They want what they expect. But what works is something that surprises the audience and engages them. So I swear, you know, on whatever book you want to give me, every single ad that's been successful with the public has been hated or fought against by the politicians and their teams, you know.
Well, I mean, that's just true of all advert. You know, if you said to someone, you know, what's your favourite ad? Nobody says the 20% off washing powder. They say the great Guinness ads, or, you know, Peter Kay and a John Smith ad, or You've Been Tangoed. Like, the ones that resonate in your mind, which often have nothing to do with the product, but tell you something and generate a reaction. So go on then. Have you both got a favourite ad? Is there an ad that you think does tick all those boxes, that did find its moment and find the message and find the audience and did everything it was supposed to do? David, let's start with you first, because I bet Mark's got a list as long as your arm.
Oh, my gosh. I don't think I do, to be honest. I think in part because I think what Mark said is right on, that, and we have another project, myself, my collaborator, Josh Kalla, and a couple of our PhD students, Matt Easton and Christian Caballero. We have a study where we went to a bunch of political practitioners and we had measured the effects of a bunch of different messages on a bunch of different issues, kind of what's persuasive. And then we asked them to predict what was most persuasive. And we found basically they had no idea. And so I think what that goes to show you is it's part of why this kind of testing is important, is it's really hard as humans to predict complex phenomena like persuasion. And it's not because the people that work in politics are stupid. It's just, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to predict. And so you have to be willing to let yourself be surprised and to say, you know, it turns out this really resonates with people. And so I don't know that I feel like I also don't trust myself to judge what's most good. I feel like we have to go get the data.
Go on then, Mark. What was it? I know that there'll be one right at the forefront of your mind that you're thinking that was the one that had it.
You know, I'm not going to give you a New Labour one because they are obviously all unsurpassable. So instead, I'll give you one American one and one European one that I worked on. The American one I didn't work on. Tad Devine made the ad America for Bernie Sanders.
I'm Bernie Sanders and I approve this message.
Simon and Garfunkel song set to the people of the country going about their daily business, but in a way that felt kind of patriotic and forward-looking. It was the most successful ad of that campaign. It was interesting when they tested it, because the first cut had quite a lot of Bernie Sanders in it. And when his wife watched it and she saw him come on screen, she said, oh, God, that's killed it. So they actually recut it to take him out, that he only appears very briefly and at the end. And I thought that was a great lesson in humility, but also a beautiful, surprising film that felt patriotic from a guy that you wouldn't normally ascribe that view to. And then in Europe, just very quickly, Bertie Ahern's last election victory in Ireland.
Today's historic agreement marks a new beginning for all of us in Northern Ireland, on the island of Ireland, and in these islands. It's a day we should treasure, a day when agreement and accommodation have taken the place of difference and division.
It's right to say that we would never have had the peace process in Northern Ireland without Bertie Ahern.
I was in a meeting 3 days out. His campaign advisor, PJ Amara, said, do you know what? I've just been to the bookies and put 300 on. And Bertie said, do you really think I can win? And PJ, who smoked at the time, took a drag and said, I don't say I'll put it on you. And anyway, we put out an ad about the peace process and Bertie's role in it. And in his autobiography, it says it's the ad that won in the election. And I made that ad. So I think rarely do ads change things. But when they do, it's a really lovely and beautiful thing and something that I think is to be cherished. So, yeah.
Well, it's been brilliant to speak to you both, and brilliant to know that there is some science to it. But in the end, it's just human beings telling stories. And that's why if we could predict everything, it would be really boring. But it's human beings telling stories and changing lives. So, yeah, the high-minded aims of politics are still there as well. David Bookman, Mark Lucas, thanks both for joining us on Times Radio.
And there'll be plenty more on the art of political advertising, I'm sure, throughout this election year. Let me know, which adverts do you think work? Which do you think maybe landed badly? You can email me, matt@times.radio, or WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. But for now, from me, Matt Chollets, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.